Welcome back to another episode of Life Sci AI, the podcast series. And we are very, very excited because we have somebody within the DTX community coming to join us from a company that is also very heavily involved with both digital therapeutics innovation and also pushing the industry forward as well. So in this episode, we are going to be delving into the company and the person behind, or one of the people behind the company. The company is called Beats Medical, and I'll leave the CEO, Cara Clancy, to introduce herself in detail, because I will not be able to do it justice at all. So please introduce yourself, Cara, and happy to have you on the podcast.
Delighted to be here, Nick. My name is Cara Clancy. I'm the founder of Beats Medical. Beats Medical was founded over 11 years ago to take clinically proven assessments and therapies out of hospitals and into homes for people with central nervous system and rare disease conditions.
Awesome. So we've had Brain Plus on. So Kim, obviously, you know very well as well, Cara. So 11 years. What's happened in those 11 years for Beats, and I guess how have you then started working with Beats, and how did you get to this point, I guess, is the first question.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess to get to this point, I remember the exact moment I decided to found Beats Medical. I was working as a physiotherapist in a hospital, and my next patient, a person with Parkinson's disease, was 20 minutes late. I went out to find him stuck frozen at the main entrance. He was coming into me for a therapy called metronome therapy, or auditory cueing. It's kind of like a beat or sound wave that helps cue and control normal movement and help him overcome these symptoms. The only problem was this therapy had to be individually prescribed, so it was only available in the hospital. And he needed this every day, not just in the hospital. And really, these symptoms persisting despite medication are very common in central nervous system conditions and in rare diseases, actually. In fact, there often aren't any drugs. But in this, despite many advancements in healthcare, this particular patient was still taking a drug called levodopa, which was discovered over 50 years ago then. And these symptoms of walking, speech, and hand movements can still persist despite that. So it was for this reason that I became passionate about pairing digital therapeutics and assessments with drug therapies to enhance care and really provide a more holistic treatment program for these patients.
So back then, what was the landscape like when, you know, you're saying, looking at like apps or technology and trying to sort of pair that with a drug or replace it with a drug or use that where drugs aren't being utilized efficiently, such as rare disease, for example, because it's probably thinking it was 2013. So you think about what the app store might have looked like, let alone what the technology sphere in this realm looked like.
Yeah, in 2012, things were very different. Yeah, the number of people with smartphones even was a lot less. When we first went out to develop, we built a team around this and developed this technology. It took a couple of years to really understand how do we use smartphone sensors to individually assess people with impaired movement, speech, or hand patterns. It's not that straightforward to do so, and it took some time for us to be able to calibrate to these particular individuals and prescribe the right beat or therapy or whatever that was for them. We set about doing some trials around that, and when we cracked it, we could see it, particularly in the first product in Parkinson's. The person getting the right prescription was able to walk with ease and overcome those breathing symptoms. And we thought, hospitals will bite our hand off for this. Of course, they know they need this. This takes an hour, sometimes an hour and a half, getting the right prescription ready, playing sometimes, and I will use the word tape, not even CD or MP3 or anything like that at this stage, and getting that right beat playing in the clinic. It made sense, right? Helping these individuals to be empowered to work on their independence and their walking at home. But while there was enthusiasm and we had clinicians giving it to patients themselves, there was no I suppose it didn't look like a drug or a pill or how you treated or worked with Parkinson's disease. So getting hospitals to pay for this was a challenge. And I think many DTx companies will tell you it's still a challenge. But it was actually in one of our trials that our patients who were using it said, please don't make us wait for this. We want access to this technology now. We did not intend to be a direct consumer product initially. But because of what patients asked for, we did that. And then skipped to today, 11 years on, and we focus specifically on, while we do have a direct consumer product still on the market, we focus very much on pharma partnerships where we bring those products to market together. But I definitely think that early stage of working with patients has made our products stronger. I think products should be so good that even if they're reimbursed, patients should be willing to pay for it. And we've had users all around the world pay over $365 a year for this access to our Parkinson's product out of pocket, which is unheard of in this space. And we've some users on this technology over 7 years. So products should have that impact. Our overall goal is all of our products will be reimbursed. We have attained landmark reimbursements, both public and private, for our products. And the plan in the future is to continue to attain this for all our products, whether they be our own or direct through partnerships with pharma, which is our focus now.
Wow. I just want to just make sure everyone heard what you said there in terms of products should be so good, the patients should want to pay for it themselves, in terms of the reimbursement challenges that are coming through. And not obviously saying that everyone should be forced to pay for healthcare, but they should want to understand that the value is there because the product is that good and changes their lives that much.
Yeah. So I really believe that they shouldn't have to pay for it.
Yeah,
the goal is that they shouldn't. But I think sometimes in healthcare, we accept a lower standard of user experience, maybe, or value. And I think, you know, people say, oh, people don't know the value of a drug. They don't know how much the drug costs because they don't pay for it. Well, I think they do know the value when they see that impact and that outcome, and they adhere to the drug and they take the drug. All of that is a sign that they value it. With applications, I think it is important that products are built of a quality that these users value it. And again, in the hope that they value it with that. But I think we were kind of forced to continue to improve the product, enhance it. We had have on that Parkinson's product a support line as well to help them get set up. And through that, we got a lot of feedback, good and bad. And this is where that engagement with the end user, if you didn't continue to improve and advance it, they wouldn't continue to use it. And so they're not getting benefit from it.
No, absolutely. And I think that piece as well, just to make sure it's around the product development and having it at such a high standard. And that's what you're thinking about all the time and raising the bar, as it were. Going into then like the process of that, were you very early on engaging with your patient groups, getting sort of understanding of pilots out there, or, you know, getting them involved with the early R&D, or did you sort of create in-house and then put it out there once you thought it was ready? Which way around did you go?
So the background of the team, I come from a clinical background, and I'd done a PhD in looking at the predictors of outcomes of neurosurgery, and really looking at how we use data to understand first what we need to do for patients and how they are and how those outcomes are delivered. And then my chief medical officer came from a medical background. So we kind of had some of the clinical in-house already, but we understood that this was not sufficient in terms of understanding something that goes into a user's home and their day-to-day lives. So we felt it critically important that everything we built was founded in science and data, and that how that was delivered and how that was worked was with 100% collaboration with people with neurological conditions from the very beginning. This involved endorsements and partnerships with major advocacy groups, one-to-one meeting with our users. So I think for us, that was really critical, and it's still critical today. I mean, a week or two ago, we brought in users who've been on our technology for many, many years, to speak to them, to see how they're getting on, to understand again their needs and how they might change. So I think it's critically important that they are engaged from the very beginning. And I think it's fundamental to creating great products that will be used this is, I suppose, for me, what our end goal has always been is to delight those users. And I think we've seen that. I mean, we initially aimed to look at increased stride length, increased arm swing, things that clinically are quite relevant, right? But to a person with Parkinson's, they might say, well, if you improve my hand movement and I can make a cup of tea, that's more important to me than a couple of inches of dexterity. Yeah. Same with if I can walk to the shops, that matters then. Oh, you've a lovely longer stride length. But they took it even further. We had users walk, one user, John McPhee, who walked from the bottom of the UK to the top using our technology over 620 miles and something we never thought possible, obviously enabled by him and his passion and his and what he went for. But to know that the technology could play a role in supporting someone like that went beyond what was intended when we first founded the company. And this shows you, if you give people with neurological and CNS conditions, rare disease, the tools to take control, what they can do with that can be pretty special. And sometimes that's just walking to the shop, and that's also an Everest as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to delve into sort of like impact and purpose and how you set Beats Medical up to be driven in that way. But before that, wanted to delve into what has been a hot topic in the last 12, 18 months across both DTX and also into wider digital healthcare as well. And it's all around pharma partnerships. Because as you said at the start of the podcast, around your new strategy, around working in partnership with these pharmaceutical companies. But for those who perhaps don't know what a pharma partnership is or can look like, could you just sort of set the scene to explain as best you can in layman's term what a pharma partnership means for a company like Beats?
Yeah, so I think pharma partnerships were not fully on the plan at the beginning. Hospitals and payers were, which have been notoriously in the market slow to move. And we've seen pharma really start to adopt these innovations and look to put them out there at scale. For us, the pharma partnership side of it really came as we went nearly a decade into our work. I noticed that that patient in particular, and that those patients with people with Parkinson's were still taking that drug, which was now discovered 60 years ago. And I realized that while it was valuable to pair digital therapeutics with drug therapies, there was a huge amount of value and understanding that we've built up on the accuracy of assessments, being able to assess a person with a CNS or rare disease who have altered movement speech patterns. Is quite a sophisticated system to do that based on many years of data and learning to be able to do that. And we felt that there was a need to understand these conditions to deliver better therapies. So when we delved a bit deeper, we found that 85% of neuropharmaceutical drug trials fail. And this is leading to a lot of reduction at times in R&D investment in these spaces and people being on these drugs for such a long time. So we realized that we would look to pair our assessments with this pharmaceutical industry to help them discover these new therapies of the future, whether they be drugs or digital therapeutics or combined. And in doing so, that led to some increased demand and more clients coming to us from the rare disease space saying, there's 6,000 rare disease in the world and only 500 of them have approved drugs and therapies. Can digital assessments and biomarkers that we provide help understand these conditions in a way that helps drive more drug and therapy discoveries? And we're really passionate about that. Yeah. It's any form of therapy that these digital assessments can drive. And I think in terms of what those pharma partnerships mean, it's really about finding the right partners who are looking for that end user impact at the end, which is something we're so passionate about.
And so when you're looking at sort of engaging with pharma, and this is something that, we're just chatting offline, if you recall this, a week after DTX Berlin, and there was probably the similar topics in DTX West, and there was when I was in Health Frontiers as well, around these sort of pharma partnerships. What is the important bit that a company like Beats needs to hold dear to their heart to make sure that it becomes a common partnership where you have a common goal, rather than not just thinking, right, I'm going to get a pharma partnership and then I'm sorted?
Yeah, I think, I believe that a pharma partnership is not the definition of success. I think, you know, that's super, super important that, you know, both a DTX company and a pharma company come together, understanding that that initial step to partner is not the success bit.
Yeah.
The success bit is that users are using that digital therapeutic many years on, or that that digital assessment tool has helped identify change and detect change, hopefully for the identification or discovery path towards a new therapy or drug. And I think that area is so, so important that we know when we work with a partner that their goal delivers value for the patient at the end, and that both sides do have to consider delivering return on investment. You know, so for us, we now work with pharma at the R&D phase. So we provide all of our objective assessments are delivered on bring your own device, no requirements for additional hardware. So getting patients on in a frictionless way into their clinical trials and getting that data as quickly as possible to help them to understand first the patient groups. In the rare disease, sometimes there's no validated outcome measure, let alone a validated therapy program or drug for it. So we really go in at that side to help them find and discover those new drugs. And we know that discovering a new drug for pharma is not the end of the journey.
Yeah.
Getting payer reimbursement for that is also a challenge. And it's at that point we pair our digital assessments and therapies with the drugs to provide value add for market access. And I really believe that at the end of the day, where pharma and DTX companies need to remain aligned is that end user. I think pharma has tried to put out digital applications before in the past. I think they've missed the mark a little bit on the patient end user. I think DTX companies can move a lot faster. They work a little bit closer, maybe I would say, with the patients outside of clinical trials, maybe. And as a result, that is a combination, I believe, for success, because pharma brings a lot to the table and so do DTX companies. But alone, I think it's harder for both to succeed.
No, absolutely. There is always that sort of co-development piece that's absolutely needed. But interestingly, I want to get your thoughts on two things that came up from DTX Berlin around pharma partnerships. One of them was around the margin differences and the stakeholder management differences. So obviously drugs work on a very high margin, and digital therapeutics don't work as a higher margin as that sometimes. I don't think anything works at a higher margin than drug therapy, to be honest. So that's sort of one thing to think about, like, how does the stakeholder management, and when you're going to the shareholders, how do you provide the value of DTX versus the value of the margin for drug therapy? And then to attach that to a sort of a follow-up would be, when a pharma company is there to sell your product sometimes, how do you make sure that the sales force for that pharma company that's used to selling drugs can sell a digital therapeutic as well, which is very different in terms of sales cycle?
Yeah. And I think the third aspect of that is, how do they sell in a market that's not fully established? So we talk a lot about product market fit in what we do. And, you know, in the space of digital therapeutics, the market is still emerging. And great products have in the past, historically, in multiple different industries, been market creating or market shaping.
Yeah.
And I think great digital therapeutics will continue to become market creating and market shaping. So that kind of backs that salesperson a little bit as well, with a product strong enough to do that. Back to my original piece, you know, the product should be valued by the end user. To the first part of your question, which is maybe just give me a quick reminder on the first part of your question.
Yeah, it's sort of like when you're, if you're in a position where you're going to a pharma company and you're trying to sort of validate your route to market or why they should engage with you, take resource away from their very high margin drug therapy program and put resource into the digital therapeutics companion or substitutes, why would they take resource from their very good money-making machine into yours?
Yeah. So I think, you know, like any drug, drugs can take a long time to even in themselves get that payer reimbursement, become established in the market, etc. They have their challenges too, and so did digital therapeutics. But digital programs in pharmaceutical industries have notoriously been a little bit short-lived. We've seen big top leading pharmaceutical companies create digital units, and they become the first thing to be cut when things don't go so right, which is unfortunate because it's not necessarily a reflection on the team, the people, and the work that's done by that pharmaceutical company. It's just a reflection on, it's still seen a little bit as a bell and whistle. I think that will change. I don't think it's changed yet. So we believe it's very important to deliver and show value for our pharma partners as early as possible, which leads to a longevity of a project. So we bake into the R&D phase. We show reduced costs, improved outcomes, a higher level of data, higher level of retention engagement by pairing digital assessments and biomarkers to measure objective measurements of speech, walking, well-being, whatever that is, remotely in patients on a bring-your-own-device basis. That delivers relatively immediate return for areas they're spending in already, which is R&D. The R&D budget doesn't get hit as quickly as maybe that digital budget. In doing so, we come into their value chain and we grow with it. If they discover a successful drug as part of that, we continue to follow them with digital assessments. If they decide that drug is now going to be successful, again, if we take, for example, rare disease as a good example, this is a major drug discovery and finding. Okay, but now we need to get it reimbursed. And there's still, despite it being rare disease, I mean, in fact, in rare disease, they have some higher challenges. We need to get this reimbursed. And that's where, in cases like rare seizure conditions, for example, the drugs being discovered may stop the seizures. But the advocacy groups are saying these patients still have issues with their walking, speech, and hand movement. Amazing, these drugs can reduce the seizures, and in some cases, which is amazing, prolong life. But what about quality of life in those years? And that's where we pair the digital therapeutic as we grow through the value chain with the client to say, this is a drug with therapies for walking, speech, and hand movement. And not every condition will have all three of those or well-being as well. But I think it's really about growing within the value chain and showing value to the pharma client for those pharma teams as quickly as possible. Because I do get the sense when you speak to pharma teams, particularly in the digital innovation space, there is that feeling of, you know, how long do we have to do this? And how quickly can we show results? And we do both. As I said, we do work on the commercialization phase as well. And we work with products that have been commercially trialed already 7-8 years on the market. So that really helps in terms of you've got some sort of track record there and recipe almost to follow. Then when you see sometimes these products developed by committee with 22 people around a table, throwing everything into it and out it goes in the market. And then, oh my gosh, no one wants to buy it or pay for it, or payers don't want to take it, and the sales guys don't know how to sell it. So sales guys and girls don't know how to sell it. So it's all of that kind of thing that needs to be, I think, in terms of a recipe for next steps and value chain value creation. I think it's really important that you go in with that together as a partner.
Yeah, and so when you're completely understanding that, you know, that the long-term development piece and partnering with them step by step and in lockstep almost, and growing with them, what can be sometimes the cultural differences between an innovative, you know, innovation-led startup and a big pharma company, especially, that you might want to make sure that you have in your rearview mirror that might be some challenges potentially to that co-development strategy?
Yeah. So, you know, we have partners, including top 10 pharmaceutical partners. We have private and public payer partners. And we've worked kind of across the spectrum of different partnerships and continue to and grow within those. But I guess I look back on, you know, the first bigger kind of partnerships that we've done in the past. And I think I do think there's a cultural difference. There's definitively a cultural difference between a startup and a big pharma, for example. Startups move a lot quicker and they're scrappier in what they do. And there's this kind of relentless, probably, pursuit of the next step. Yeah. Pharma has to, by its nature, work a little bit slower. It's more bureaucratic. It's an older system. It's a bigger system. I mean, sometimes we have conversations with four different groups in a pharma company about four different potential partnerships, and none of them know about each other or talk to each other, and it's not that they don't get on, it's just such a big industry,
just right? Like, you get an email and you're like, I'm here for like 10 years and I didn't know this person existed in my company. Like, it's like that big.
They don't, exactly. So, but I think there's a beauty in that, in how these two groups come together and work together. As a startup, you need to adapt to the pharma culture, and pharma can begin to start to adapt to you. And I started to realize that while my first perception was that, gosh, things are a little bit slower, et cetera, you know, I'm ready to do things yesterday and adapting to that. But what I have started to realize is actually some of these units, these digital units within big pharma, work a bit like startups in a different way. They may be a multi-billion dollar profitable business, but this team only has this small, I mean, maybe they tell you that as well, right? But they do have guardrails on their budgets as well. And they also need to show that return on investment as quickly as possible. So I really try when we work with a pharma partner to sit down with them first, understand what it is their goals are for the short term, long term, and really work to almost their own KPIs within that. And sometimes their KPIs could be 6 to 12 months. Sometimes you're explaining what a tech KPI is because it's a startup terminology, right? Yeah. But I think in working together, I've truly seen incredible outcomes. And I know some of the partners we've worked with have said, gosh, like, this is the fastest we've ever moved. And I'm going, I feel the opposite, but this is also great that you've moved faster than you usually move. And I think that's the really exciting bit where, you know, while they might move that little bit slower, the impact that we can have as a company with a pharma partner is far greater than maybe we can do alone. So while it might take them quicker than they're used to and us a little bit longer than we're used to, and the overall impact and end goal of that is the same. So I think it's just both can learn from each other, which is why I really believe that true success in digital therapeutics will come from these partnerships, which is why I think you see the emergence of digital therapy units, or, you know, the likes of Astellas or X being founded, which are saying we have a remit to build digital therapeutics, digital assessments, digital biomarkers, and we have a remit to partner. And I think that's the exciting shift we've seen in the last 12 to 18 months. And I think that's what actually I believe now will drive the biggest shift in BTX, is people want to partner now, and these units are now set up to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the really interesting thing that I forget around what pharma companies are kind of there to do as well is to make sure that they are de-risking as much as possible. Like, they're in a very cautious and conservative part of R&D. So you got to think around, thinking about the stakeholder management, if they're taking away a drug that has been in the market, it's worked for 60 years, the doctors trust them, they're trusting their name, and they've been, some of them have been around for hundreds of years. And so a startup who's been around for 3 or 4 years, you're asking them to put their name to this, you're asking them to put their reputation on the line for this. So they, that's where they come from when it comes to the sometimes the cautiousness or the slowness is more because if they put their name to something, they're putting a lot of their reputation on the line as well when they go to market with what you are creating together. So just having that appreciation of where they're coming from, but then also them having the appreciation of where you're coming from, and like I said, meeting in the middle as best as possible to create the results at the end of the day.
I think it's really about coming to the table with each side knowing what they know and what they're good at. And, you know, for us, I mean, we use assessments like the timed up and go, 6-minute walk test, 2-minute walk test, all automated, no hardware, bring your own device, all of these common outcome measures, which are also used in other conditions like oncology and respiratory. But we really focus on CNS and rare disease because we've our assessments are tailored around that, but certainly the accuracy levels we have are in excess of 98-99%, which is much higher than even a lot of the state of the art. But we also have been able to commercialize in these spaces successfully before. Mm-hmm. A degenerative condition which gets worse over time is very different commercializing in than a condition that might be more acute or have a different trajectory. So when we work with pharma, we think it's so important in terms of de-risking is that we know when we come to the table, we see ourselves as one core technology, multiple disease indications. So it's not a case of we'll throw this and this and this in it. That has not been commercialized, safety tested, risk tested on the market for many, many years. We say, look, there's a recipe here. You can pick a couple of ingredients because we know this and this about this disease. But at the end of the day, this is the kind of proven technology that hits the market. This streamlines regulatory processes, it streamlines commercialization processes, it streamlines a lot of what we know. And I think that's made a huge difference in terms of, I know there can be companies that split between being an app development company and a digital therapeutic core product company. We are very focused on customizable core product, but we are a core product. And that's because we don't believe that if a partnership that doesn't scale is a failure. And for us, we want to know from the very beginning that we can see joint success, that we would even hang our own hat on the chances of this project succeeding. And if that gets derailed in any way, I think that's where the risk comes in, where both sides start to do something that they don't understand, that they're not familiar with and don't know how to grow. And I think that's, for me, something that's very important in a partnership that at all sides kind of know or have trialed or tested how this will be successful in the market.
And that goes to the, you know, the, it has to be a means to an end and not the end in itself. We could probably talk about this all day, and I think a lot of people can talk about this all day, especially when it comes to the DTX community. But one thing that has been always clear with you and Beats is the purpose of what you're looking to achieve. And so just to sort of start to set the scene for the sort of second half of what we're going to talk about, what is your purpose?
For me, it's estimated that 1 in 3 of us will be affected by a neurological CNS condition in our lifetime. And I, you know, I went into physiotherapy, you know, from a young age. I first witnessed the impact of neurological conditions on people's lives and said, I want to be a physio to do that. But being a physio, I felt like I was falling short. People still experiencing these issues at home, needing more. 82% of people with neurological conditions experience issues accessing care. That number has not dropped in the last 10, 11 years. And if anything, it's getting worse. So I'm very much driven by the fact that we want to make sure that we can put the tools to take control in as many people with CNS and rare diseases hands as we can. And those tools to take control can be unlocking and helping discover new drugs, or pairing new drugs with our digital therapeutics, or delivering digital therapeutics. Either way, the means is to try and make sure that people with CNS and rare diseases live better lives because of the work that we as a company do. And I think in a sense, you know, people talk about, again, all these different things that you do in business. But I mean, at the end of the day, like in front of me in my office are letters of thank you or little successes, like I said, by grandchild's name for the first time in a few years. You know, when you work with a pharma partner or a payer, or you deliver a new product on the market, it's fundamentally so stories like that come back, you know. And I think there's a billion people in the world that we want to help with these conditions. But I think for us, it's about those individual stories, that deep level of impact, have that first and then multiply that by a billion. Because I think, you know, it's not about low touch with these people. I mean, as I said, we've technologies that users are on doing assessments daily and walking and therapies daily for over 7 years. We form part of what we believe is their management of their condition and their empowerment and their quality of life. And everything that we do as a company, that's the definition of success. The first one of those out is always a huge feeling, and then when you begin to multiply that is something even more special again. But you never forget those individual stories, and you carry them with you throughout all the work you do. And I know my team do as well. I certainly have a very easy job with my company culture and motivating my team, because it's not me, it's those individuals we meet frequently, we talk to, we interview, we make sure are part of our stories, we make sure push us forward. They're the people that we do it for.
Yeah, and so as you then look to develop culture and scalability as well to some certain extent, or pharma partnerships or different indications or different areas, how are you going to keep the inch wide, mile deep sanctity of purpose clear to what your mission is?
I think that's the big thing that we found even with partnerships, is that, you know, even if our partner may not have as much of that focus, that we try and keep that ongoing engagement throughout our whole business. Yeah. Certain areas that help us with that is we still have a direct consumer product on the market, so we still, You know, we can never get ahead of ourselves, bearing in mind that a user that started using your technology 7 years ago and a user 7 years later is not only different in terms of the technology and the new apps on their phone that have changed, but equally their condition is different as well. Their needs have changed. You know, there are more areas that we have started to develop as a company, including in areas of cognition and things like this. So, you know, we grow with our pharma clients, we grow with our users.
Yeah.
So I think for us, the best way that we've continued to stay connected in that is to make sure that that engagement becomes fundamental and part of what we do. And we run various projects throughout the year, whether that's on our pediatric products or our adult products, or even products within partnerships, where we continue to learn from users. And I think for us, rare disease has been even more eye-opening again, because access to those users can be a little bit harder to understand their struggle and their challenges. And I think that's something that I think for the whole team has been very eye-opening as well. I mean, anytime I work with a rare disease client or partnership now, I don't want to say all the time, but I would say at least 50%, that's actually probably ambitious there, well more than 50%, I have to Google the condition. I've never heard of it before. And I'm sitting there learning about this new condition. And then I'm going, okay, now I know the clinical side of the new condition. What about the patient's experience of this condition?
Yeah.
And I think that's, I have to say that is something that I do enjoy, though, in terms of being able to work to that individual user's experience and make sure that each product is tailored to them and their condition.
Yeah, and I think for me as well, I know Cypro have the same values of you in terms of the rare disease. We've been in this space for longer than we've been in the digital health space. You know, when we partner with our charity partner called Designability, and we raise money for sort of a like a little mini e-bike that the toddlers can use for the ones who can't walk, and they give them out for free to families and such. And normally once a year, when we sort of give them the money over, we go down there, we see them and see the difference in a child being able to not be that, you know, free roaming toddler, because they've got the restrictions to being able to be that free roaming toddler, and the parents then going, what have you got on our hands again now? Like, but it's just the smiles, it's just the impact on life, which is just something that you can't really can't sell, and you can't explain that until you've had a sort of lived experience around it. And one thing I was really interested in your opinion on was, where does DTX fit within rare disease? And could this be one of the biggest opportunities for DTX to make that impact that we think it all can do?
Yeah. So for me, I think rare disease, and particularly in our work, goes way further back than DTX. It's in a much earlier stage.
Yeah.
So when I first met these clients that were coming to us in rare disease, now we're talking everything from, you know, your leading global pharma partners to a rare disease company who's raised a significant Series B. So that this is the kind of range of companies we speak to in the space. But I think the big thing that we have to remember within, I suppose, rare disease as a whole, when we first met it, we were saying, oh, they need therapies. They, you know, as I said, 6,000 rare diseases, 500 approved drugs.
Yeah.
But actually, no, it, as I said, in many of these cases, they don't even have an approved validated assessment tool. So the ability to measure change isn't even there. And in some cases, I say, do we know if they have speech issues? We're not sure. We think they do. We're not sure.
Yeah.
So it's such an area of discovery. And this is where I think, you know, there's been a huge amount of talk about AI, and it's something we use ourselves in machine learning over the years. And I think, while I believe that this will drive significant breakthroughs for rare disease, if we look at the past, anything, you know, and I really believe this in all of our own AI work, is, you know, quality input leads to quality output.
Yeah.
And the best biomarkers in the world, whether they be scans, PET scans, x-rays, ultrasounds, molecular biomarkers, they've all come from sophisticated tools for data collection, whether that be, again, those x-rays or your microscope. You need to be able to collect quality data at scale to then feed into models to find these discoveries.
Yes.
And I think there is a need to make sure that in every project, the quality input is a really core focus. Otherwise, we will make discoveries that later we retrospectively find are not actually what we thought. So it's something that we've worked so hard on over the last many years, and nearly a decade now, is this training on being able to look at a microscopic level at a person with a rare disease's walking, speech, hand movement, understand how that is, what that looks like, and then use that to then inform models on what is the best form of therapy, treatments, or even discover what where should we be going at the very least, because we know that in a lot of these studies, many studies score zero, insignificant findings, whether it's rare disease or CNS.
Yeah.
In some cases, you don't know if you're going in the right direction or the wrong direction, even if you knew, and we say, we like to help pharma measure in millimeters, not meters. Yeah. So at the very least, you know, you're getting a little bit closer or you're moving a bit more further away. And I do think that data and digital biomarkers and digital assessment will lead to breakthroughs in rare disease at a pace I think we've never seen before. And I think digital therapeutics will just take that little bit longer for the market to be fully ready for that, because a digital therapeutic at this point without a drug, it's often not good enough for these people with rare disease. It's the extra thing we add on top of the discoveries that I think is so critically important, because at least in Parkinson's disease, while some of these drugs were discovered 60 years ago, the drug still exists and it does a good job in some of the areas that are very important. And we address the things that are around that. But for rare disease, the need is so critical, so immediate, that I think that's where data and digital biomarkers play a bigger role and digital therapeutics will come.
Yeah, yeah. So you're more in terms of the rare disease space, it's more around the assessments and sort of tracking to make sure there is a direction, and then working in, with partnerships with those individuals, sort of either, like I said, biotechs that just got some good series A, series B, but also in a large pharma. We work with a number of rare disease companies, which I'm sure you probably work with as well, in terms of, but what they're doing is so patient-led, so purpose-driven, and it just lends so much so nicely into what you have been creating and continue to create at Beats. The question I just want to pose to you now is around a unicorn. So something that was said at the last conference we were at was around an impact unicorn. So not chasing the valuation of a company, actually chasing the impact of a company. And it was put that a billion people would be an impact unicorn. So thinking about like rare disease, and obviously there's probably you could probably get to that level, I guess, but would you see yourself as looking to achieve potentially a billion in terms of direct or indirect, or would you be caring or looking to focus more on like a million people affected in a million ways, maybe? If my maths is right.
I think it's the depth of that impact which is so important, right? And I think this is the piece around measuring success by valuations, measuring success by numerics that might not be meaningful. Even for me, when I first started measuring success by increased stride length, right? If the patient doesn't give a damn and you're very impressed but they can't walk to the shop easier, sorry, but your metrics are not actually driving true impact. So for me, the impact is, if there's a billion cups of tea made by a person that couldn't make those cups of tea before, if there's a billion trips to the shop that were more difficult than they were before because of the fact that we were around, if there is a drug, and I think rare disease is a really interesting one where you're not chasing the billion people, but the impact that you have. I spent some time working in a tertiary children's hospital with some children with rare disease, and you can see the impact of these game-changing surgeries or therapies or things that are developed or tried and succeed for these children is so powerful on not just that child's life, but a whole family's life and how that trajectory passes out, because that one child is surrounded by carers, supporters, people who love them around them. Yeah. So I think people sometimes think rare disease, it's so rare. It's hugely impactful for the individual and everyone that goes around them. And I think measurement of success goes beyond just the individual's life you change, but it's the people around that. So I think that those metrics for measurement need to come from the depth of impact. I think in terms of unicorn, I think we're in a market where the market, as I said, is still establishing. So some of the financial metrics around valuations, etc. I mean, you know, we have digital tools that have 100 million in revenue a year. I mean, I speak to some of the more kind of well-being products in not necessarily DTX, but kind of skirting the line between us. Mm-hmm. But 100 million in revenue a year is a failed drug, right? It's not what pharma is looking to partner and grow these things. So I think fundamentally, it's really about building upon products that are sticky and that people want to use and are building that value and building that with the pharma access ability that drives will deliver that unicorn of impact. But I think in terms of, you know, I think the industry has struggled in terms of its unicorn status. If we talk to valuations and financial side, yeah. I think that's just a figment of the market and where it's at right now, and it will get there. But until it gets there, yeah, the drive to just have that impact and that sustainable impact should be everything. And I think that's probably what's needed right now in the digital therapeutic and the pharmaceutical industry in these partnerships is sustainable impact, because unfortunately, I think we've seen a lot of players fall. And I don't necessarily think that's down to a bad product or a bad business. I think it's down to market and timing. And in any breakthrough innovation, some trailblazers will fall. Yeah. And we thank them for it and we appreciate it because we all learn from them. Mm-hmm. But it's a part of this industry that, you know, this is not an established industry where you just put a product on the market and suddenly it becomes a unicorn. And the payers need to come into play and there's still regulatory stuff. Like everything is still getting there slowly. So it's really about sustaining that impact. And for us, I mean, we have users who rely on our technology. And if there's anything that drives us to make sure that we continue to stay on the market and deliver sustainable impact, it's them. We never want to take those products away from them.
Yeah. And I think that is a really nice finish to sort of what you were explaining around the patients never go and they drive your impact and chase their impact rather than chasing the valuation all the mm-hmm. time, and you won't go wrong and create that sustainability. And that's why you've been around for so long, you know, and why you keep pushing forward the industry and what you're doing. So we definitely have to have a follow-up one because we've not even got through everything we wanted to talk about today. But no doubt we'll see you in the coming year and what you do. And I don't know, how's the best way? If anyone's got any questions, I'm sure they have got questions off this. What's the best way to get in contact with you, Kiara?
Through our website or social media or whichever way suits people best, we are always open to speaking to any new partners. www.beatsmedical.com allows you to have a look at some of our products and some of our partnerships and what we do and continue to do for people with CNS and rare disease.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you very much for coming on and just keep doing what you're doing. It's awesome.
Thanks, Nick. Lovely speaking to you.
Bye-bye. Bye.